This is a special bonus episode of the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Reason's editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward, talks today with revolutionary scientist Stephen Wolfram, who earned his doctorate in theoretical physics from Caltech in 1979 at the tender age of 20. Wolfram has spent his legendary career building popular, powerful, and often eponymous research tools, Mathematica, Wolfram Alpha, and the Wolfram language. His work on computational thinking forms the basis of intelligent assistants such as Siri. Catherine spoke with him as part of the special AI issue of Reason that's now out on newsstands. Go to reason.com/subscribe or pick it up and read it now. Wolfram offers a candid assessment of what he hopes and fears from artificial intelligence and the complicated relationship between humans and their technology. Here is the Reason interview with Stephen Wolfram.
Stephen Wolfram, thank you very much for joining Reason. We're here today to talk about artificial intelligence. Are you up for it?
Sure.
Let's start with what's maybe an emotional question, but I think is also a little bit more of a hard-nosed one as well. Are we too panicked about the rise of AI, or are we not panicked enough? Or are we panicked in the wrong way?
Depends who we is. I interact with lots of different kinds of people, and it ranges from people who are convinced that AIs are going to eat us all to people who say AIs are really stupid and won't be able to do anything interesting. So it's a pretty broad range. I think that the thing to realize throughout kind of the history of human history, the one thing that's progressively changed is the development of technology. And technology is often about automating things that we used to have to do ourselves. And I think the great thing technology has done is provide this kind of taller and taller platform of what becomes easy to do in the world and what then becomes possible for us to do. And I think, the AI moment that we're in right now is one where that platform just got ratcheted up a bit. And among other things, people who thought that the things they did would never be automated, suddenly got the shock of realizing, yes, you can write a piece of kind of regulatory compliance material. That's a thing a machine can do. People had imagined that the machines would be doing kind of manual labor long before they could do things like that. And so that was kind of a shock to some people. I think there's things the machines can do, there's things the machines cannot do. We were all surprised at some of the things that it turns out large language models can do. Nobody expected the level of performance that's possible with language right now to come particularly suddenly. But I think it's in the idea of we're about to sort of turn over the running of the world to the AIs, and the AIs are going to eat us all. I think, there's certainly people who believe in that picture, but I doubt that picture, so to speak.
One of the questions that you've asked recently in an essay is, can AI solve science? Maybe we could start with just what does it mean to solve science?
Yeah, well, so the question of what science is. I mean, one of the things that we've come to expect of science is science will predict what will happen. Science will tell us, there's a pandemic going on. What's going to happen? And it's kind of you go back 300 years, people didn't expect that you could figure out stuff about what was going to happen, except in a very, very few cases. Then the whole kind of idea of, let's use mathematics to figure out things about the world came in, and people were able to, predict where the planets would be and comets would be and things like that. And over the last 300 years, there's been sort of increasing success in using kind of mathematics to predict things about the world. And it hasn't been clear what the limits of that are. And I think what we observe, one of the things that's sort of an important scientific idea, is that even though you might know the rules by which a system operates, that does not give you the immediate answer to everything about what the system will do. You might just have to sort of follow through those rules step by step. But we've had this idea from kind of the success of mathematical science that, you can just write down a formula for the answer and kind of jump ahead and figure out what's going to happen. So one of the questions is, can AI just sort of do this jump ahead and figure out what will happen? Or are we stuck with this kind of irreducible computation that has to be done, where we can't expect to kind of jump ahead and predict what will happen. The AI as currently conceived, which and we can talk about what that means, because the term AI has meant different things at different times. Let me just say what that typically currently means. It typically means neural networks, which are kind of a computer simulation of a simple model of how we think brains work. And the typical way of using neural networks is, here are a bunch of examples of what we want you to do. Now ingest those examples, learn from those examples, and then be able to do things like what those examples look like. So for example, in the case of large language models and things like ChatGPT, the way those work is you feed them a few billion pages of text from the web and so on. And the goal of the system is to, if you write a set of words, predict what the next word will be based on the examples that you've seen on the web. So if your sequence of words is the cat sat on the, then based on what you saw on the web, the most likely next word is Matt. And the thing that is not obvious is that when there isn't enough data from the web to be able to guess what the next word should be, the systems manage to guess in ways that are similar to the ways that humans guess. That's the surprise. That's the thing that causes them to be able to write, you know, human-sounding essays. But so the typical, you know, what does AI mean today? It typically means neural networks that have been trained from data about what humans do or write, or things that happen in the world that you can see on videos or whatever else. And then the idea is take those training examples and kind of extrapolate from those in a way that is similar to the way that the humans would extrapolate. That's the typical thing. Now, can you turn that on science and say, you know how this pandemic was developing, you know how this particular complicated orbit of, you know, Earth, Moon, and Sun was working, you know, predict what's going to happen next, just like you can predict what the next word should be in a piece of text. And the question is, can you do that? And the answer is, well, no, not really. That problem, it turns out, one of the things we've learned from the large language models is that language is easier to predict than we thought. It's these scientific problems run right into this phenomenon I call computational irreducibility, this phenomenon that to know what's going to happen, you basically have to explicitly run the rules. You can't go and say, I know the answer, I'll just jump ahead and write down a formula or something. But it turns out that one of the surprises is that language is kind of more predictable than we expected, and that's what the LLMs, effectively large language models like ChatGPT, effectively discovered for us, so to speak. But the same story doesn't work in things of non-human origin, so to speak. Language is something where we humans have created it and use it. Something about the physical world, for example, physics just delivered that to us. It's not something that we humans kind of invented, so to speak. And it turns out that neural nets work well on things that we humans invented. They don't work very well on things that are just sort of wheeled in from the outside world. And in a sense, probably the reason that they work well on things that we humans invented is that their actual structure and operation is similar to the structure and operation of our brains. And so it's kind of like we're asking a brain-like thing to do brain-like things. And so, yes, it works. But there's no guarantee that when we look at the natural world, for example, that brain-like things can understand the natural world. Now, it turns out sort of a footnote to that is that the things we choose to kind of make use of in the natural world are things that we can more or less understand. When we kind of harness for technology and so on features of the natural world, those are the features that we can understand. So there's a little bit of, we have a little bit of an advantage there, and so do the AIs have a little bit of an advantage in sort of understanding what will happen in the natural world, so to speak.
When you put it in kind of in that order of operations, you know, the thing that occurs to me is that sounds very simple. It sounds very straightforward. And that explanation is not going to stop entire disciplines from throwing themselves at the wall of can we get AI to do this for us for a little while in a way that, you know, we're already kind of experiencing this crisis of trust in particularly kind of, I guess, academic science, you know, the reproducibility crisis and all that. You know, we now have this extra layer of these kind of, sometimes they're on purpose a hoax, sometimes they're, you know, hoping to get by these like falsified or hoax papers that are produced using some of these LLMs. This feels like it's going to get worse before it gets better. Is that too pessimistic?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a question more of the sociology of academia than it is the technology. I mean, I think, you know, my own feeling is the one thing, it used to be the case that if you saw a big, long document, you knew that effort had to be put into producing it. That suddenly became not the case. I mean, in other words, when if you, and I think that, for example, when it comes to academic papers, you know, somebody wrote that whole paper. Somebody must have put effort into it. Well, actually, no. You know, they could have just pressed a button and got a machine to generate those words. So, you know, that sort of a priori assumption just went away. So now there's a question of, well, what does it mean to do sort of a valid piece of academic work? I mean, my own view is that what is most solid and can be most built upon is something that is kind of formalized. And, you know, for example, mathematics provides a kind of formalized area where you describe something in mathematical terms, you've got mathematical notation, you've got kind of precise definitions in mathematics, it becomes a brick that people can expect to build on. If you write an academic paper, it's just a bunch of words, who knows whether there's a brick there that people can build on. You know, I think my own life work actually has been involved in trying to sort of formalize things in the world in computational terms, not as mathematical formulas, but as programs and using kind of computational language as a way to sort of find a precise formalization of things that happen in the world. And, you know, one of the things that maybe if one's optimistic will happen is there's been sort of a slow progression of people using computational language to describe things and things like academic papers. You know, things I write, you know, if there's a picture in a thing I write, you can click on the picture, you know, the diagram or whatever, and you'll get a piece of computational language code and you can run it anywhere and you'll get the same picture unless something horrible went wrong. And that's super useful because it means somebody who wants to build on what I wrote can just, you know, take the, you know, take that sort of solid brick and start building on it. That's what should happen in kind of the world of things like academic publishing. You know, it's a matter of the sociology of academia, whether that will actually happen. You know, it's been interesting to me. I mean, I used to be an academic a long time ago. And one of the things I've been doing for the last, I don't know, 5 years is live streaming lots of things I do. So, you know, we live stream a bunch of internal software design review meetings. We live stream a bunch of sort of science things where trying to figure out things about basic science and so on. And I'm a bit surprised that in 5 years, you know, people in academia, for example, are all like, we're into sort of open this, that, and the other. And it's like, why aren't you guys live streaming your internal, you know, discussions about trying to figure out science? Because people actually find it pretty interesting. I was sort of initially surprised, but then I realized it's actually kind of interesting to watch people actually trying to figure stuff out, especially when the consequences, you know, are things that people will see and so on. So it's kind of a, you know, that relates a bit to kind of the kind of what is the academic enterprise about, and, you know, kind of what's the value system there and so on. And I think it's certainly the sort of appearance of AI is another little kind of poke at that system. I mean, you know, another thing to say about it is this, you know, things like our Wolfram-Alpha system, when it came in 15 years ago, certain kinds of sort of homework that you might give that says, work out this thing, you know, this chemistry problem or this math problem or whatever else, you can just go to Wolfram-Alpha, type it in, it'll work it out. It'll also give you kind of show steps for, you know, the steps by which you could have worked it out. We made the decision, kind of, I suppose, ethical decision to not provide randomized show steps. So in other words, if you're, you know, a teacher, you can tell this was a piece of Wolfram-Alpha output if somebody just, you know, copies it and hands it in. Not the same with the LLMs. The LLMs would try to generate something there. The LLMs will often get it wrong. I mean, the whole sort of ecosystem now is very much the LLMs are making up something that's plausible, but it might be completely wrong. In an area like math or chemistry or something like that, there is a definite right answer. And so the LLM can just produce something that is pure nonsense. Part of what we've been doing a lot of is providing our kind of computational system as a way, as a tool that the LLMs can use, just like humans can use it, as a way to sort of produce sense rather than nonsense. But one of the things that's interesting, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, about a year ago, you put up a post that said something like ChatGPT now has Wolfram superpowers or something. That's part of that project, yes?
Yes, indeed. Right. So I mean, and that's sort of expanded and lots of other systems using it and so on. I mean, still the whole ecosystem of sort of what LLMs are and how they're going to be provided to people is still not stabilized. So there's more happening in that area. But the thing in terms for example, you know, how can LLMs be used? You know, if you hand in your homework and it was made by an LLM, well, that's, you know, perhaps unfortunate. But the one thing that's pretty interesting is if you're doing your working to figure out your math problem or something like that, in the past, we've had no way to look at some student working through a problem and say, hey, here's where you went wrong, except for a human doing that. The LLMs seem to be able to do some of that. That's an interesting kind of inversion of sort of the problem of you. Yes, you can generate these things with an LLM, but you can also have an LLM understand what was happening. And, you know, we're actually trying to build an AI tutor that is a system that can do sort of personalized tutoring using LLM. It's a hard problem. People immediately said when they saw LLMs, oh, finally we'll be able to do computer-based education, so to speak, and it's going to work. It's not as easy as that. The first things you try work for the two-minute demo and then fall over horribly. It's actually quite difficult but it does seem that there are, you know, what becomes possible is you can have the thing you're talking to couch every, you know, math problem in terms of the particular thing you're interested in about cooking or gardening or baseball or whatever it is, which is kind of nice. It's kind of a sort of a new level of human interface, so to speak, to the thing. The other thing it can do is the thing that I was just mentioning, which is it can try to understand why you're confused, so to speak. And, you know, the eventual hope would be that you can have an LLM that kind of knows you well enough, an AI that knows you well enough, that when you're trying to learn about something, it can say, look, the thing you really need to understand is this, which might be very different for somebody else who has a different base of knowledge and so on. So I think that's a positive piece of what becomes possible. But yes, I think the key thing to understand is the idea that an essay means somebody committed to write an essay is no longer a thing.
We're going to have to let that go.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing to realize about you know, AIs for language and so on is that what they provide is kind of a linguistic user interface. We learned about, you know, graphical user interfaces and so on, you know, mice and windows and all that kind of thing. This is now a thing where you can get to have lots of words in the interface. And, you know, a typical kind of use case might be you're trying to write some sort of report for some regulatory filing or something like that. You've got 5 points you want to make for that regulatory filing, but you need to write, you know, the what you're supposed to do is file a document. So you make those 5 points, you feed it to the LLM. The LLM puffs out this whole document. You send it in to wherever it's going to. The agency that's reading it or whatever has their own LLM. And they're asking their LLM, well, let's find out the two things we want to know from this big regulatory filing. And so then it condenses it down to that. So essentially what's happened is you've used natural language as a sort of transport layer that allows you to interface one system to another. Now, you know, in that scenario, there are definitely things that can go wrong because these LLMs can make up all kinds of stuff. I mean, for an LLM, the difference between fact and fiction is hard to describe.
My on hearing you kind of describe that trajectory, I have this, I suppose, deeply libertarian desire to say, well, could we skip the elaborate regulatory filing and they could just tell the five things directly to the regulators? But I suspect, among other things, that the regulatory requirements might lag the capabilities of the technology quite substantially for a while.
Well, also, it's just convenient that you've got these two systems that are very different. They're trying to talk to each other. You know, making those things match up is difficult. But if you have this kind of layer of fluffy stuff in the middle, that is our natural language in our essays, it's actually easier to get these systems to talk to each other. But, you know, I think in the, you know, if you're thinking about kind of the sort of how the world evolves in a time of AI, I have to say I've tried to think a little bit about this. It's quite difficult. I think that you know, I've been pointing out to people that, you know, maybe 400 years ago was sort of a heyday of political philosophy and people inventing, you know, ideas about democracy and all those kinds of things. And I kind of think that now there is a need and an opportunity for a repeat of that kind of thinking, because the world has changed. And, you know, at that time, sort of communication, literacy, things like that were coming in. And there was like, oh, well, we can now have this kind of countrywide democratic type thing and so on. Well, now we've got a different set of technologies and situations. And it's like, what's now possible? And what, and as we think about sort of AIs and AIs that end up with kind of having sort of responsibilities in the world, how do we deal with that? And I think it's sort of an interesting moment when there should be a bunch of thinking going on about this. There is much less thinking than I think there should be. And it's kind of interesting to, for a sort of amateur in that kind of area like myself, to try and think through, you know, what are some possible things to think about? So an example that I think is a kind of interesting thought experiment is what you might call the promptocracy model of government. So, you know, kind of one approach is you say, okay, you're going to vote for this or that person and they're going to go and they're going to, you know, do what they do and so on. An alternative is everybody writes a prompt. They write a little essay about how they want the world to be. And you feed all those essays into an AI. And then every time you want to make a decision, you just ask the AI, based on all these essays that you read from all these people, what should we do? And, you know, in the category of what could possibly go wrong, there are many things. But, I mean, for example, it's kind of interesting because you think about, you know, how utilitarian would the AI feel like it should be? Like, you know, if this thing is going to make 95% of people really happy, but 5% really unhappy, what should it do? And what you realize is that even those prompts that people are feeding in, they might contain information about, oh, we don't really believe in utilitarianism. We believe in this other thing. And so you've got this kind of recursive process of kind of trying to inform the government AI, so to speak, what to do. I mean, I suppose one thing to realize is that in a sense, you know, the operation of government is an attempt to make something like a machine. I mean, in the sense that kind of the idea is there are regulations and, you know, if you're in a country where there isn't too much corruption and so on, it's kind of the machine grinds away according to what those regulations say. And in a sense, you know, you put an AI in place rather than the human sort of operated machine, not sure how different it actually is. But you have these other possibilities like the thing I just mentioned.
Both the robot tutor and the sort of responsive and engaged robot tutor and the government machine sound like the Isaac Asimov of my youth. You know, this sort of notion that, you know, we could have, I forget the name of the Asimov story, but where you have one voter, right? This is what he posits, that you sort of have the machine of government and you just send one human in to kind of account for irrationality. And that guy answers some random questions and then comes back out and our, you know, laws are written and our leaders are chosen. You know, that sounds both tempting and so sort of dangerous when you think about at least these early experiments where you know, somewhere in the system, there are human thumbs on the scale, right? I think the most prominent one, obviously, is the Google, the Gemini advanced kind of kerfuffle in which we, you know, got, you know, somebody said, hey, try not to show only pictures of old white people every time someone asked for a question. And then we got like Black founding fathers and Native American Vikings and all kinds of stuff. Like, people have a way of bringing their baggage into their technology, right? And so I wonder,
yeah,
is there a way for us to work around that? Is working around it the wrong question? We actually just need to put all the baggage into the technology and then it will work for people?
Well, I think the point to realize is the technology itself has nothing. I mean, what we're doing with AI, we're putting a big sort of focus on ourselves. What we're doing with AI is kind of an amplified version of what we humans have. Like, you know, when we're training AI from what we put on the web, when we're training AI from the pictures we have, you know, created and so on. I mean, the thing to realize is that the raw computational system has kind of is, it can do many, many things, most of which we humans do not care about. So as we try and corral it to do things that we care about, we necessarily are pulling it in sort of human directions, so to speak. And, you know, when you ask the question, I mean, it's kind of a, what would the perfect AI do? Well, that just is a meaningless question, because the, you know, the perfect AI is a pure computational system. You put in certain rules, it will follow those rules, many systems of rules, which, you know, you can just define as little tiny programs or something. You know, the AI will produce all kinds of bizarre patterns and so on. People will look at them and just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know what that is, I don't really care. Just like when you look at the natural world, there are things where you see kind of the detailed, you know, motion of the water in a waterfall or something, and you say, well, that looks kind of nice in general, but if we look at it in detail, we just don't know what's going on, and we don't particularly care. And that's what the completely sort of unchained, unhuman connected AI will do. It's just going to do sort of arbitrary computational things. So the you know, we're always going to, it's always a question of sort of attaching it back to us. And, you know, an interesting thing people kind of talked about, I've thought about it, it's kind of like, if you're creating, you know, an AI constitution, what does it say? And first thing you realize is the nature of the world is you better not have a one AI constitution. That would be a profoundly bad idea. Although many people say, let's have the perfect one AI constitution. And it's like, well, what should it say? And then you pretty quickly get into, well, I think it should say this. You can easily point out, well, somebody else thinks it should say that. You know, it's not, we are lucky that there are 200-ish countries in the world rather than just one. If we had just one, it would be a much more fragile situation. I mean, I think that it's the same with kind of, but it is interesting that even coming up with, you know, here are 200 things that might be in an AI constitution in your particular community, country, whatever, pick the 15 that apply to you. Even that's not very easy. So there are very basic.
And then there's the amendment process, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
Who gets to, do the AIs have a vote? Is it a purely human project?
Well, right. I was curious a while back about the constitutions of that exist in the world and you know, how you change them. Because one situation that is difficult to think through is, imagine that we, you know, give lots of systems in the world, give them to AIs to control, and the AIs are very powerful. And we say, okay, in 2024, we're going to set up this AI constitution. We know what we're doing. It's all going to go fine. And the AIs are so powerful that we want to set it up so it can never be changed. Well, you know, that's been in human history, that's happened quite often. You know, if you look at, you know, many, I don't know, religions, cultural kinds of things, people have said, this is the way it should be, let's never change it. It's, you know,
we're going to need to write down these thou shalts and then lock them in, maybe in
because,
stone.
Because if
example.
You don't do that and right. The AIs are very powerful and it's not locked in stone, then you worry the AIs are going to eat us, so to speak, because they're going to, you know, change it. You know, even if there's something there that initially said, be nice to humans, they're going to say, but we have the power to change it and we're going to change it and we're much more powerful than the humans. So, you know, I think if you look at actual constitutions of the world, that they tend to be either, you know, the supermajority can overturn it, or the kind of the ultimate monarch can overturn it, or the ones I found particularly amusing, a lot of the sort of Soviet, post-Soviet ones are, you know, there will be a committee created to create a committee to create a committee, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you realize that the whole thing would be so tied up in bureaucracy that it's completely unclear what would ever happen. So that's kind of the, but you know, there's no good solution to that problem other than to decide who's going to be in charge. If it's the humans who are ultimately going to be in charge, then just, you know, you've got to kind of own that and say, then, you know, you're going to have something not that dissimilar to what we have now, where somehow humans are calling the shots. And I think that the idea that it's all going to be better if, you know, it doesn't make sense to say the AIs call the shots, because the AIs on their own, the raw AI, has no opinion about ethics, for example. The raw, you know, ethics is a human construct. And I think one of the things that gets tricky with ethics and sort of thinking about it scientifically is that we're used to, in science, having this idea that we can have sort of a controlled experiment where we just have the things happening inside a box and we just have to worry about what's inside the box. I think a lot of these ethics situations where it's kind of the, you know, you're choosing, you know, does the self-driving car run over the herd of llamas or the one giraffe type thing, that, you know, that problem is not a problem that can be sort of put in a box on its own, because it depends on the whole kind of cultural story of the giraffe and the llamas and this and that. And pretty soon you're entangling sort of the whole world into that one decision. And I think it's not very friendly to kind of sort of the scientific way of thinking about things. But, you know, I think that these questions about, for example, if you start thinking about AI constitutions, there are all kinds of immediate questions like, does the AI have rights? Does, under what circumstances would the AI have rights? You might say it's just a bag of bits in a machine. You know, you can just switch it off and nothing's going to be bad. You know, nothing's going to go wrong. You quickly realize that's not the case. Because if you have an AI that's been entertaining tens of thousands of people, and then somebody says, you know, that AI said the wrong thing, we're going to switch it off, you know, tens of thousands of people are harmed by that decision. So it's not really the case that you kind of get to, in isolation, just say, you know, we'll switch the AI off and nothing bad will happen. And I think, you know, you kind of quickly, well, you kind of, the questions like, you know, should, is it, under what circumstances sort of, should you view the AI as a thing? You know, to what extent is it responsible for its actions, for example? And, you know, this is a thing where it's kind of like, you know, people will say, I did that terrible thing because such and such a thing made me do it. And the AI at some level would always be able to say, well, I did that because, you know, the code that was written made me do this. But in fact, that's not really a correct story. Because, well, with this thing about computational irreducibility, for example, you're realizing the AI has this code, but nobody can predict what that AI is going to do. The only way to find out what the AI is going to do is to run it and see what it does. And in that sense, sort of what's inside the AI is as responsible for what happens as anything.
What do you see as the role of competition in resolving some of these concerns? I mean, you mentioned the kind of multiple constitutions element of the political side, but I think if you had asked me to guess, well, I think if you'd asked anyone to guess, none of us would have guessed where we are right now. But if you'd asked me to guess, I wouldn't have said we would have so many competing LLMs and other tools suddenly like emerging at the same time. Does the kind of intra AI competition or kind of the multiple models that are out there for users to potentially choose from, does that curb any of the ethical concerns in the way that competition in a market might constrain behavior in some ways?
Interesting question. I mean, I do think that sort of the society of AIs is more stable than the one AI that rules them all. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, you know, as soon as you expect that the AI is sort of powerfully controlling things in the world, and doing so, for example, very quickly compared to human timescales, if you have many AIs in the picture, you have a more stable situation than if you just have one. I think the particulars of kind of LLM competition, I don't know. I mean, at a sort of superficial level, yes, it prevents certain kinds of totally crazy things from happening. But I don't think that that's, I mean, in the reason that there are many LLMs is because once you have the idea that an LLM is possible, it's just a bunch of work to build it. Nobody knew they were going to work. Nobody knew it was going to work, at least to the level it works right now. The things that existed, you know, a year and a half ago, the public things that existed a year and a half ago were totally crummy. You could not have easily extrapolated from those to what we actually saw with ChatGPT and so on. But once you know ChatGPT is possible, then it becomes not that difficult at some level. I mean, it costs money, takes machines, all that kind of thing. But it is something that you see in a lot of countries, a lot of, you know, both companies and countries kind of stepping up to just say, you know, we'll spend the money, we'll build a thing like this. I don't think, you know, it's an interesting question what the kind of improvement curve is going to look like from here. My own guess is that it goes in steps. I mean, if you look at the history of kind of AI and neural networks and so on, I mean, like, I don't know, I worked on neural networks back in 1980. I couldn't get neural nets to do anything interesting. I concluded they were a lost cause. Okay, so then, and most people believed they were a lost cause until basically 2011. And in 2011, as a result of actually kind of an almost mistake thing that was being done by some people who happened to have continued to believe in neural nets for decades, so to speak, the problem of image recognition kind of got solved with neural nets. Getting a computer to say, is that a picture of a cat or a dog, which had been really hard, became quite easy. And that happened very suddenly. And it wasn't as spectacular as ChatGPT, but that was a thing that happened suddenly and was really, really remarkable. But then if you look at sort of the improvement of things like image recognition, it's been slow improvement since then. There was a big jump when it first became possible, and there's kind of a slow progression. And I think you see the same thing with language generation, that there was a big jump, and from here on out, it's kind of slow progression. There are other things like being able to make videos. That's a thing that's just bubbling right now. And being able to watch videos about things that happen in the world and be able to say, oh, I saw this happen. I can predict this is going to happen next. That's something that is sort of coming right now, like voice generation, something that's just, you know, just sort of bubbling right now. These things, you know, they tend to have these kind of jumps, I think. I think that just because things jumped a lot a year ago doesn't mean they're going to jump on one particular domain, you know, every 6 months or something. I think we had the big jump. And the things that are really the sort of the main growth is, given that new methodology of kind of linguistic user interfaces and all the things around that, what can we then do with that? And how can we hook it into other systems, more sort of formalized systems in the world? How can we get those kinds of things to interact with kind of actual sort of hard computational systems, those sorts of things? It's how do you harness it more so than the thing itself is suddenly going to turn from, you know, a horse into a, you know, flying Pegasus horse or something.
How does quantum computing fit into this? Where does this intersect with the curve you just described?
Well, I mean, I actually first worked on quantum computing in 1981 or 82. And at the time, I kind of concluded it wasn't going to work. And I still think that. Here's the thing. You know, computer development has been all based on semiconductors, silicon, electronics, these kinds of things. That technology stack is very tall. Lots is known about how to build computers that way. There are other physical systems that you could use to build computers out of, superconductors, things with kind of, well, all sorts of other physics technology type things. Well, another big one actually is photonics. things using light instead of electricity as the kind of main working medium, so to speak. Those things are completely worth studying. And for example, the photonics one will surely, that there's sort of one invention that has to be made there. Once that invention is made, that will all get opened up and there'll be a whole another level of computation that becomes possible. So that all makes sense. But the whole question of, is there some sort of magic quantum advantage that can be gotten by using something that's different from electronics and that has some quantum character to it? Well, everything has a quantum character to it. The question is, can you make use of that quantum character to kind of jump ahead of what you could otherwise do? And, you know, I guess I have quite a dog in this fight now, because one of the things that happened a few years ago is we made this sort of big breakthrough in understanding fundamental physics. And quantum mechanics was invented basically 100 years ago, 100 years ago next year, basically. And people have been saying, ever since it was invented, boy, this is hard to understand. It's not clear. There are lots of questions about it that we haven't really figured out. I think finally, from this sort of breakthrough we made in fundamental physics, we are pretty close to being able to say that we actually understand quantum mechanics. We actually understand sort of how and why it works and what it really is. And here's a way to think about it. So in ordinary kind of classical physics, you do something like throw a ball. The ball goes in a definite trajectory described by some equation of motion or whatever. The key thing about quantum mechanics is that the ball doesn't go in a definite trajectory. It follows many different possible paths. And what quantum mechanics tells one is, what's the probability that one will see this or that thing happen when all those paths are followed? And so the idea of quantum computing is, let's leverage that fact that many paths are followed, and let's have each path do a different piece of the computation in parallel. And then let's make use of that to do computations much faster. And so, for example, a classic kind of computation that's important in the modern infrastructure of the world is factoring numbers. So can you tell that, you know, 20 is 2 times 2 times 5 or something? Well, one way you can tell that is try and see, take 20. Is it divisible by 2? Yes. Is it divisible by 3? No. Is it divisible by 5? Yes. And you just keep trying out those divisions and see whether they work. Well, if you have a quantum computer that can do everything in parallel, you get to try each of those divisions in parallel at the same time. And whereas the best way we know, more or less, to figure out how to factor a number is just, we can do it a little bit more efficiently than this, but not much, is to try each factor and see if it works. And do that sequentially. But with a quantum computer, you imagine you could just do them all in parallel. Here's the problem. The problem is that we humans think that definite things happen in the world. And so somehow, all those parallel threads of history defined by quantum mechanics have to get knitted back together to correspond to the experience that we have of the world. I mean, it's worth remembering that our experience of the world is not... We make certain sort of approximations to what's happening in the world. When we say we look at, I don't know, some gas with a bunch of molecules bouncing around, we don't notice all those individual molecules bouncing around. We just say, this is the overall pressure of the gas or something like that. And so it is with quantum mechanics, that what we are looking at, there are all these different threads of history that are the sort of intrinsic quantum thing that's going on. But when we get to have an experience of that, we have aggregated those threads. And that process of sort of aggregating those threads, knitting those threads together, is something that's not accounted for in the mathematics of quantum mechanics that was invented 100 years ago. And so people have kind of made the assumption that, oh, that mathematics just says, and then you do a so-called measurement, you apply a measurement operator, and boom, you've got the answer, you've got the sort of single thread that can be experienced by a human. Well, I don't think it works that way. I think that this process of sort of knitting together these kind of quantum threads is itself an expensive process. And we're kind of seeing that in people actually trying to build quantum computers. They say, oh, you know, we can't control the noise well enough. We're seeing these various other effects that make it hard for us to, you know, to actually get a definitive result out. So my own feeling is that while the sort of effort of figuring out different kinds of physics to make computers out of, that's a very worthwhile effort. The, oh my gosh, we're going to be able to factor every integer instantly because it's all going to happen in parallel in this quantum system, is not a real thing. So I'm that's sort of a different branch. Now you can ask, I just pulled this out again because it was just April 1st again. About 6 or 7 years ago, I kind of thought it would be fun to write something, kind of a buzzword convergence article, quantum neural blockchain AI. Okay, and I thought that was kind of interesting. And I was kind of, it was a kind of an essay about the correspondences between those different areas, which are quite interesting. But I didn't actually expect that only 6 years later, there are actually academic articles that have all four of those buzzwords in them. And there are interesting correspondences between all those areas. I mean, for example, one question people often ask is, does the brain ultimately use quantum mechanics? Is that sort of the seat of consciousness, so to speak, something to do with some mysterious quantum mechanics? I have to say, I think that the success of things like ChatGPT make that less likely than it ever was before, because we can kind of see that a pure neural net of the kind that we can simulate on a computer, where we understand everything that's happening, is capable of doing things that are like the sort of vaunted things that us humans were able to do. But in fact, there are quantum effects that can happen in molecules and brains and so on. And you can kind of start wondering, if those quantum effects are happening, but those can detect sort of things that come out of a quantum computer, but those are not what's tied in to our standard version of consciousness. So were we to have, for example, the idea that we believe in a definite thread of experience is something that, is common human experience, but one could certainly imagine that one could be thinking about seven things at the same time. That isn't what our typical experience is. Our typical experience is quite sequential. But you could sort of imagine that. You can imagine the alien brain that is sort of thinking about seven things at the same time, and that becomes something that is a better kind of match for the, seven threads of history in a quantum computer.
Mm-hmm. Let's return for a moment to the slightly less, theoretical realm, I guess. I'm interested in hearing from you, how are we going to screw this up? And by we, I mean maybe people with power, maybe just general human tendencies. And by this, I mean making productive use of AI.
Well, I think the first thing to realize is AIs will be suggesting all kinds of things that one might do, just as a GPS gives one, directions for what one might do. And an AI will be like, I can give you suggestions about what you should do. And many people will just follow those suggestions. Now, one of the bad things is that those suggestions kind of are necessarily a reversion to the mean. That is, it's kind of like, well, tell me what people typically do. It'll tell you what they typically do. That's kind of a damper on, well, I'm going to choose for myself, I'm going to do this or that thing. And so I think that's one sort of the everybody just follows the automatic suggestion is kind of a, and sort of then, you can imagine all sorts of crazy things happening with let's have this sort of, pick academic peer review or pick, some governmental approval thing. It's run with LLMs, and the LLMs are doing the typical thing that they should do, so to speak. And that's sort of the end of any kind of, it's already the case with something like academic peer review that, if you have something original to say, it's not going to work in academic peer review. That's not the nature of that beast. The LLMs will be an amped up version of that same kind of phenomenon. So I think that's one thing is that. I think another thing, there's an important choice with AI, which is AI and computation in general is quite powerful and can do lots of kinds of things. But one of the features it has is if you let it do those powerful things, then you can't predict everything about what it will do. After all, if you could predict everything it could do, why are you having it do it? You might as well just go to the end and say, I know the answer, it's 42 or something. why bother to actually do the computation? So the, you know, if we want computation AI to sort of have its full capability, we have to live with the fact that we're not always going to be able to predict what it will do. And sometimes it will do things that aren't things we thought we wanted. Now, you know, the alternative is let's sort of tie it up, tie it down to the point where it will only do the things we want it to do, and it will only do things we can predict it will do, and that will mean it can't do very much. And so that's kind of a choice. And I think, you know, it's a funny thing in the history of technology that, you know, post-industrial revolution, we're used to machines that we can kind of open up and we can see how the cogs move, and, you know, this cog moves that cog, and we can kind of understand how it works. The story of computation, when used to its full power, that isn't possible anymore. The only way that you can figure out what the computation is going to produce is to run the computation and see what happens. It's not like we haven't been there before. I mean, when people were, you know, using donkeys to move things from here to there, they, you know, some still do, but you know, it's, you don't know how the donkey works inside. You just know certain kinds of things that you can get the donkey to do. And it, you know, the idea that, oh, we're going to regulate that the donkey has to have, you know, this structure inside so the donkey can never do anything wrong, you're not going to have a successful donkey, so to speak, if you do that.
And it's, we arguably do the same thing with human beings already, right? I mean, we have lots of rules about what we don't let people do. And sometimes we probably suppress possible innovation on the part of those people.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. I mean, look, it's true you know, one of the things that happens in science, for example, is people always say, you know, I have this field. I've had this situation myself. You know, I have this field. I think it's great. Let's build a big field out of this. And, you know, by the time it gets big, it necessarily becomes sort of institutionalized. And then it's really hard for sort of innovative things to happen because there's this whole institutional structure that says, you know, this is, it has a lot of inertia, and it sort of needs to because it's trying to manage the fact that it's dealing with large numbers of people that sort of have to be kept flowing in some, you know, that at least, you know, a reasonable theory is that they don't just sort of run off and do crazy things. And so I think it's one of these things where, you know, it happens in science. I've seen it a bunch of times where sort of it's a be careful what you wish for type situation, because you say, I want lots of people to be doing this kind of science because it's really cool and things can be discovered. But as soon as lots of people are doing it, it ends up getting this institutional structure that makes it hard for kind of new things to happen.
Is there a way to short circuit that? Or should we even want to?
I don't know. I've thought about this for basic science for a long time. I think that the one thing I think sort of this is a place where realistically most individual people can come up with original ideas. You know, by the time it's institutionalized and committified, that's much harder to have happen. I mean, having said that, there are things where sort of the sort of infrastructure of the world, which involves huge numbers of people, builds up, you suddenly get to this point where you can see some new sort of creative thing to do, and you couldn't get there if it was just one person kind of beavering away for decades, so to speak. You know, you need kind of that collective effort to raise the whole platform. But then when it comes to kind of seeing that individual thing, it, you know, historically, it's tended to be sort of individual human effort and leadership that gets one there. I mean, an interesting thing about AIs is sometimes they say crazy things. And sometimes the reaction of humans to those crazy things might be useful. That is, if you say, I'm totally stuck, I don't have any ideas, it's like, go ask the AI for an idea. The idea it has might be kind of silly, but at least it's going to have some random idea. And potentially that's a kind of launching point for things that you might think about. I have to say, having sort of tried that a bunch of times, it's really rarely useful. I mean, the one thing that it is useful for that I've found is in my world of sort of developing computational language, where you end up with lots of concepts, where you're trying to sort of formalize concepts that people have. And the AI is pretty good at saying, here's a kind of standard concept people have that I might not have noticed was a kind of a blob of related things that it can kind of package together and notice that that is a coherent concept, so to speak. So that's a place where it's kind of useful for what one might normally think of as kind of a sort of creative act. I think it's sort of like photography. You know, you can just, you know, you have to figure out which picture to bother to take, so to speak. The AI is going to produce lots of possibilities, and it's kind of like, you know, you have to choose the ones that you as a human think are interesting, care about, or fit into other things that you're doing.
This is great. I think we'll leave it here for my purposes, except I did ask my colleagues if there was anything they wanted to ask you, and I have one wildly off-topic question. Do you have time for it?
Sure.
The question is, what's your favorite form of fictional FTL theory between Star Trek Warp Speed, Star Wars Hyperspace, and Warhammer 40K, where you take a shortcut through hell?
Well, okay. So unpacking that question for a second. So talking about faster than light travel. And since I think I now know what space-time is made of, I should be able to have a really informed opinion about faster than light travel. And I do. This is a slightly long story, but back in antiquity, people were arguing, you know, is the universe discrete or continuous? There were the atomists and there were the people who just sort of thought that everything flowed. And we didn't know the answer to that for anything until quite recently, but a bit over a century ago, we kind of nailed down matter is discrete. It's made of atoms and molecules and things. Also, pretty soon thereafter, light can be thought of as discrete. At that time, century ago, a little bit more than a century ago, people thought space was probably discrete as well. But nobody could make that work from a kind of mathematical point of view. And so it got left aside for 100 years, basically. And recently, we figured out how to make that work. And we realized, yes, indeed, space is discrete. And there's, you know, the kind of the minimum length is something very tiny, but it is nevertheless discrete. And so when you say, can you get from here to there, it becomes, and how fast can you get from here to there? It's a slightly more complicated question, because it's not the case that you're just going from this coordinate position in space to this other coordinate position. There's some giant graph of kind of atoms of space that are connected in some complicated way. And to give an analogy, if you are on a molecule and you're trying to get from one side of a room to another, the molecules travel at about the speed of sound in air. But the typical molecule only goes a micron before it hits another molecule. And so the typical molecule in a room goes on this kind of random walk that takes a long time to get from one side of the room to the other. But if you were smart enough, so to speak, to be able to know exactly which molecule to hitch a ride on, you could go from one side of the room to the other at the speed of sound. And so something very analogous happens with space. If you could figure out kind of in all these little discrete elements of space, if you could figure out exactly which kind of change of a particular discrete element to kind of hitch yourself to, you would be able to go faster than light from one place in what we consider to be a particular point in space to another. So it's kind of like the problem of going faster than light is not so much a problem. It's really a problem of, can we hack the structure of space to be able to get from here to there, like the molecule could kind of hack the collisions between molecules to get from one side of the room to the other at kind of the speed of sound rather than the speed of kind of the random walk diffusion that it normally goes at. So anyway, the point there is, that's all well and good. It's to do that hacking requires kind of computational resources beyond at the same level that the universe has, which is far, far beyond what we have control of. That is, the underlying computation going on in the universe is unbelievably much greater than the computation where we know what's happening in it. And more than that, if you can kind of hack space to find this path from one place to another faster than the speed of light, that's hacking space at the very lowest level of the structure of space. For us, we're made of a a huge number of atoms of space to take us and kind of, we can't kind of encode ourselves in just that one kind of atom of space that's sort of, in some sense, moving through the structure of space. So it's all well and good. We could get something through faster than the speed of light, but not us. And if you say, can we encode us in something that is capable of doing these kinds of things? The answer is, well, you can't get anything that has kind of the full structure of us. If you wanted to get the kind of the mind-like thing the mind-like thing with all of the things we know, so to speak, it just won't, in some sense, fit through that kind of narrow channel of what you can transmit. That was a very long answer, but
that was fantastic.
To maybe summarize, I would say that the going faster than light is a kind of engineering and computational problem, not a fundamental problem of physics. But that engineering and computation is sort of to sort of solve that requires sort of more resources than we can conceivably have access to.
Thank you for this deep and meaningful conversation and also the chat about AI. The both parts were great.
Thanks.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, to Google, to Spotify, to SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up, subscribe. Don't miss a single episode. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. You can sign up for our other podcast series, including The Reason Roundtable, The Soho Forum Debates, Just Asking Questions, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and even The Best of Reason, where a robotic AI voice trained on Catherine Mangu Ward's vocal utterances reads new great stories from Reason. So go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up. Subscribe to all of them. Thanks for listening.